Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Ruben Stern. In the coming months, Missouri's legislature will decide whether or not to expand the state's existing Medicaid program. Last year, when the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, it was left up to each individual state to decide whether to expand the federally supported Medicaid program within their borders. At least 11 states have already said they will not expand their Medicaid programs, but increasing the Medicaid rolls in Missouri is a centerpiece of Governor Jay Nixon's budget plan for next year. The proposed expansion would provide insurance coverage for hundreds of thousands of additional low-income Missourians. It would be paid for with billions of dollars of federal funding. The governor is also arguing that the expansion would help fix the state's economy by creating about 24,000 new jobs. Opponents, though, say that the state can't afford the expansion over the long term, and they argue that the Medicaid program should be improved before it gets expanded. Today, we hope to help you understand the Medicaid expansion proposal in Missouri. What's at stake exactly? What are the reasons for and against expanding the program? And are there things on which the various sides might end up agreeing? We'll find out. So joining me in the studio to help us sort through this, first, Karen Edison is the director of the Center for Health Policy at the University of Missouri. She's also a dermatologist. Welcome to our program, Karen Edison.
Thank you, Ruben.
Glad to have you back in our studio.
Pleasure to be here.
We also have with us in the studio Representative Keith Frederick. He's a Republican from Rolla who represents the 121st District in the Missouri House. He's the chairman of the House Committee on Healthcare Policy, and he's also an orthopedic surgeon. So welcome to our program, Keith Frederick.
Thank you, Ruben.
Glad to have you in our studio. We hope that those of you in our audience will join our conversation today as well. Do you have any experience with Medicaid in the state, either as a patient or as a healthcare provider or potentially some other capacity? If so, we'd love to hear about your experience with the program. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And once again, our program is live from 2 to 3 every Monday, so that's the time to call in. And I want to start with this question. Karen, maybe you can help us with this. There's, I'm guessing, a fair amount of confusion around this whole Medicaid thing. So why don't we start off, when we talk about Medicaid in Missouri, what exactly is it that we're talking about?
That's a very good question, Ruben. I think there's a lot of confusion about what is the Medicaid program. If you're not involved in healthcare or health policy, many folks actually mix up Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare, of course, is our program for folks 65 and older and some other categories of people. Medicaid is a joint state and federal program that covers certain categories of low-income people. So it's not an across-the-board coverage for the poor, and many people think it is, but it really isn't. The way it exists right now, our Medicaid program in Missouri, which is called MoHealthNet, by the way, or Missouri HealthNet, so those words mean the same thing.
Right.
Our program covers children very generously, up to 300% of the federal poverty level. And it also covers their parents, but only up to 19% of the federal poverty level, which is, for a family of three, about $292 a month. If you are pregnant, if you are blind, if you are disabled, you may qualify under those pieces of the program. But it doesn't cover, if you're an adult and you're working two low-wage jobs and you don't have eligible children, there's no coverage for you through the Medicaid program.
Right. And is that something that would change if this goes through?
Yes. So if this goes through, this would be more of a floor or more of a safety net across our state for our lowest income Missourians. And that would be up to 138% of the federal poverty level. And for a family of four, that's about $32,000 a year. So 138% of the poverty level it would cover by way of safety net for all of those people. And, you know, at the University of Missouri, we see a lot of uninsured adults with chronic diseases. So in healthcare, we're, you know, eager to get some of those people prevention and primary care, and we're eager to intervene earlier in their disease processes rather than see them later, when many times they come to us and they, you know, they are disabled, and it's a lose-lose for the patient and for our taxpayers. So I think, you know, there are arguments on both sides about this expansion. Many people are worried about the cost, and I think those are valid concerns. Many people just sort of ideologically don't want to expand, you know, something that they consider a welfare program, and don't want the federal government to have more of a role in healthcare than it already has. And those are arguments I'm sure we'll talk about today. Mm-hmm. But many also are beginning to realize that this is an economic issue for our state. When you have large numbers of uninsured people, and we have 1 in 7 of us are uninsured in the state, roughly. You know, when you have really large numbers of uninsured people, it really does cost us all a lot in the long run. You know, state governments and federal governments, we tend to budget, our state government, we tend to budget, you know, year to year or cycle to cycle. But really in healthcare, we need to take a long view and start taking care of people where they live before they get diseases. We need to do more prevention. We need to do more primary care and quit waiting for them to come to the hospital, come to Dr. Frederick and I for their care. They need to, you know, keep from breaking those bones and protect themselves from the sun and not get all that skin cancer. We need to move from a sick care system to a real health care system.
Okay, there's lots mm-hmm. for us to follow up on there. I want to remind everyone first that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the proposed Medicaid expansion in Missouri. Joining me in the studio are Karen Edison, Director of the Center for Health Policy at the University of Missouri, and Representative Keith Frederick, Chairman of the Missouri House Committee on Healthcare Policy. For those of you in our audience, again, do you have any experience with Medicaid in the state, either as a patient or as a healthcare provider? If so, we'd love to hear about your experience with the program. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can be part of our conversation at that time, and you can also watch our video stream by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Representative Frederick, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on some of the things that Karen said. Let's start with the financial thing. The governor is touting this as a boon to the state because a lot of this money would come from the federal government. Who's to argue with that? What's the argument against that?
Well, first I'd like to say that Dr. Edison and I agree on a number of these basic fundamental concepts, and I think the overwhelming majority of citizens, taxpayers in the state would share the concern that we want to provide healthcare services to those most vulnerable citizens who just can't otherwise access the system. So the route to get there is what is in sort of discussion.
Right.
It's not the end result. We, of course, both, all of us, Dr. Edison and I and the rest of the folks in the state, want to see that happen. But one of the things that I worry about is that access to care, it does not equate to simply having a Medicaid card. If you provide a large number of folks that currently don't have access to MoHealthNet, doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be able to find a provider that will participate. Let me explain that a little bit. There are quite a number of physicians in our state and other providers, call them allied health professionals, that are sort of just hanging in there. The reimbursement is so poor that they do it out of a source of moral obligation or of a feeling of moral obligation, not really because it makes any financial sense to do it. If you take the percentage of their practice that is represented by Medicaid and say it's 10 or 12 or even 14% now, and you bump that to 20%, you may see some providers that say, well, you know, I just can't do it anymore. I just can't afford to pay my expenses, pay my staff, pay the light bill, and so they delist from the program. That could have the effect, and this is one of the things I worry about, that our most vulnerable folks that really need this the most, and Dr. Edison listed them off, could actually be crowded out and not be able to access the system, and we would essentially amount to rationing based on the amount of time you're willing to wait for services.
And how likely is that to occur?
I think it's fairly likely. When I was in practice at Lake of the Ozarks a number of years ago with several partners, and we provided care for Medicaid patients, but the reimbursement was so low that for a period of time, it was a couple of years, we simply didn't submit a bill. because the hassle of dealing with the denial letters and writing an appeal and resubmission of your documentation for the reimbursement was such an arduous process, and then the reimbursement was so low after that, that it really, we determined it just didn't make any financial sense. So we went ahead and continued to provide the services, but just didn't send in a bill. So I think it's a real concern that access would go down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the cost, we have to not only consider the cost now, but the cost into the future. You know, Missouri is one of just seven states that has a AAA credit rating, and we balance our budget every year, and we've been managing to do that without any cost increases, without any tax increases, shall I say. You know, we have to have some responsibility to the taxpayers as well to make sure that they get a good value for their dollar. If we expand a program that is widely acknowledged now to have problems in terms of access for patients, but also in terms of health outcomes, if we simply expand that program without reforming it, it'd be a real disservice. It'd be like asking a bunch of people to climb into a leaky boat. And President Obama said as much back in 2009 when he was kicking off the discussion. It was at the White House with a group of Democratic senators. And he said at that time that it's not enough to just put more people into a flawed system, that the system should be reformed. And I certainly agree with that.
Well, I want to come back to that. I want to give Dr. Edison a chance to respond to that idea about the doctors and the potential problem of more low-income people being insured. Do you see that as a problem, the way that Representative Frederick does?
Well, I certainly understand his point, and I think that's something, you know, there are always unintended consequences whenever you make some sweeping health policy change in our system. However, you know, as part of these discussions, folks are also discussing better reimbursement for doctors through the Medicaid program so that we wouldn't have this kind of dropping out of the program. You know, we see Medicaid programs. Patients at the University of Missouri, but we also see a heck of a lot of uninsured people. And so those uninsured people, if we could have more of them covered, that would be better than no payment at all for their services. So, you know, I'm less worried, I guess, than Representative Frederick about people just flat out dropping out of the program. I share his concern about just the volume, the workforce needs, and we are already stretched in our healthcare system with having a shortage of all kinds of doctors, all kinds of, you know, nurses and therapists and pharmacists and you name it. So many of us in health policy are really looking at the healthcare system of the future as looking quite different than the healthcare system we have now. You may know that I do telemedicine around the mm-hmm. state, so I go to rural, small communities every week and see patients in those communities. And those communities, they aren't big enough to support a dermatologist, but they're certainly big enough to support a dermatologist who goes there through video conferencing once a week. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to have to use technology to take healthcare to patients where they are, and then we're going to have to use a team approach to healthcare that includes the patient. You know, gone are the days when you go to the healthcare provider and they look down and tell you, pronounce what you need to go home and do. Patients now need to take an active role in their healthcare and learn about their health and learn about their diseases and work with the entire healthcare team. Ruben, you may have heard of the new medical home or healthcare home models that are being developed and discussed right now. Where
I'm not entirely familiar, so,
okay.
And I'm sure that people okay. in our audience are not entirely
okay.
familiar either,
so
that's
help
us just understand.
A new way of looking at primary care that involves not just the primary care doctor, but nurse practitioners and social workers and therapists and a whole team of people to help manage the care of patients, particularly those with complex chronic diseases like diabetes, like high blood pressure, like obesity. You know, Representative Frederick talked about how we've really need to focus on our budget and make sure we're being fiscally responsible. And I agree with that entirely. On the other hand, you know, we've seen slippage in our rankings in the country in terms of the health of our population steadily. And just last year, we slipped from 40th to 42nd. So Missourians are not healthy, and, you know, in the main, we're getting less healthy. So many of us in healthcare think we need to do something a little bit different. And certainly providing coverage to the most vulnerable as just a floor of coverage is one of those steps. You know, that's only one of the pieces of Obamacare, if you will. There are many other pieces we could talk about, but that's one piece to just provide that floor of coverage up to 138% of poverty.
Let me ask you this, Representative Frederick. You said, you know, there are things about Medicaid that need to get fixed. Is that what you were referring to in terms of the focus on the, you know, the patient being part of the management process, or are there other things in the healthcare system that need to be addressed in terms of adjusting Medicaid?
Well, we know that the healthcare outcomes for patients that are on Medicaid does not compare well at all to those patients who have traditional insurance. In fact, there have been a couple of studies that show that the healthcare outcomes in particular situations are worse for Medicaid patients than they are for patients that have no insurance.
So what sorts of things are those? What areas might those be in?
I would like to see us empower the patient more rather than have them just fit into a sort of one-size-fits-all, top-down, sort of centralized planning approach. We know that folks have better health outcomes with traditional health insurance. I have a proposal that I'm going to be moving in the House that would take the food stamp program and modify it to apply it to our health system, calling it right now medical stamps. It's not my idea. The fellow who is the father of the health savings account concept, John Goodman, put this forward in a new book that he wrote called Priceless. Basically, the food stamp program acknowledges that there are needy folks that don't have enough nutrition. But they don't have to go to a government-run grocery store. They can go to any grocery store. And when the grocer sells them the food, they don't have to take a 50 or 60% discount in the price of the goods. They sell the goods at regular cost. So the person coming there with food stamps is treated like a regular customer. In healthcare, it's not that way. So I'd like to see us look at the concept of taking the money that we're currently spending per capita on our Medicaid population, risk-adjusted, the sick folks would get more allocated than the folks that are healthy, and then empower them to spend those dollars on healthcare services. It would also empower our free market, the insurance industry, to come up with plans that would respond to what effectively becomes an $8 billion book of business of these folks that have the same as cash in hand to buy insurance policies.
So let me understand this. So is this similar to the idea of a voucher where people who qualify for Medicaid would get sort of a voucher to buy insurance from a private company?
It's along the lines of that. There's a lot of different facets to it, but that's the basic tenet.
And why is that better in terms of patient outcomes?
Traditional health insurance, as we've just discussed, does have better health outcomes. That's pretty clearly shown. I think Dr. Edison would probably agree with that.
Would you agree with that, Dr. Edison?
I would agree with that, but I don't necessarily think it's because of the Medicaid program per se. We know that lower income people have worse health outcomes, whether they're Medicaid patients or uninsured patients or otherwise uninsured patients. You know, lower income people tend to be lower socioeconomically in other ways, tend to be sometimes lower education, sometimes have other problems, and those people have worse outcomes. And that's why we need to deliver healthcare to them differently. I think it's a wonderful idea to think of innovative ways to reform the Medicaid program, but you know, my worry is we have this opportunity right now that if we lose it, we're really going to lose out on a major economic boost for our state. And one of my particular concerns is rural Missouri. In many of the little rural towns where I go every week via telemedicine, those small critical access hospitals are the major employer in that town. And I think, you know, not to get too much into the weeds, but in the health reform negotiations, the hospitals they agreed to give up some funding for uncompensated care for patients who couldn't pay or whose programs didn't pay the costs. And so they gave up some funds in the out years, assuming that the Medicaid program would be expanded. So if you don't do the expansion, but you take away the uncompensated care dollars, that's really going to put a lot of people in a hard place in terms of our smaller and medium-sized hospitals in the state, not to mention our safety net hospitals, like the University of Missouri.
Okay. I want to remind everyone real quickly again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the proposed Medicaid expansion in Missouri. And joining me in the studio are Karen Edison, Director of the Center for Health Policy at the University of Missouri, and Representative Keith Frederick, Chairman of the Missouri House Committee on Healthcare Policy. For those of you in our audience, what questions or concerns do you have about the proposal to expand Medicaid in Missouri? We'd love to hear your ideas or questions, so give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to bring real quickly the governor into our conversation. One of our reporters at KBIA, Harum Helmy, spoke with the governor last week about the proposal to expand Medicaid, and I want to play this clip from him where it sort of reveals what he has to say in terms of this federal funding question. So we're going to go ahead and play the clip, and then we'll get you to respond to the governor's thoughts on this. So here's a clip from the Governor Nixon.
The choice in front of folks is whether we're going to receive the benefit of those tax dollars here in Missouri, or whether we're going to let New York and California and Ohio and Michigan spend our tax dollars. If you took Missourians paying $1.8 billion in taxes, sent those dollars outside the state, let them be used in other places, and rolled back some of the other payments that go to rural hospitals, what you'd have is Missourians paying for other states, which would have a tremendously deleterious effect on the economy here in Missouri.
Okay, so again, that was Governor Jay Nixon speaking to KBIA reporter Harum Helmy last week. Representative Frederick, that's the argument the governor is making, and that many people are saying is that if we don't act on the money, it's going to go away, it's going to go to other states. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's not really free money, and I make the comparison that you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem in terms of our debt and our ongoing deficit spending. It's like taking this money would be the equivalent of passing the whiskey bottle to the alcoholic. It helps the short-term craving, but it doesn't really do anything. In fact, it makes it worse down the road. The fact that we are putting this debt on our children and our grandchildren, in my view, is financial child abuse. That's my major objection to it. It's not a sustainable thing. This is like a stimulus program on into the future, and it continues to rack up these deficit spending numbers that are just going to be – it's going to really put our kids at a disadvantage. They're going to – and President Obama said this as well, that it's effectively taking out a credit card in the Bank of China – and taking it out in the name of our kids and grandkids as we rack up these debts. This money is not free.
Right. Is that true, though, the governor's point, that if Missouri doesn't spend the money, it's going to get spent by some other state anyway, that the federal government's already made a decision to spend this money?
You know, for my part, I don't want to see our government go down the road of some of the European countries, Greece in particular. I think somebody has to say, look, it's not sustainable. Until we get our spending under control, I don't want to contribute to the increase in debt. And I have some statistics from the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Urban Institute that looked at the effect of expansion of our Medicaid program. And for the state of Missouri, over the next 10 years, it would be $1.57 billion. But total, including the federal contribution, is over $20 billion. Now, if you look at that nationwide, it's $808 billion. I mean, pretty soon it starts to add up to real money, what the cost of this expansion will do. And again, we're putting it into a system that is not giving us good health outcomes.
Dr. Edison.
Well, I think concerns about the costs are very real. We should probably remind our listeners, if they don't know, that the federal government's plan is to pay 100% of the costs for the first 3 years and then begin to reduce that gradually in 2016, going all the way down to 90% in 2020. So Missouri would be on the hook for picking up those costs in those out years. And I think concerns about that cost is a very, you know, valid argument. I would say, though, that, you know, we have to remember this is not just this one issue in a vacuum. This is in the context of a real revolution in healthcare. And healthcare spending last year in this country was held at 3.9%, and that was the third year in a row that health spending was 3.9%. And we had—
You mean in terms of an increase from the previous year?
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh. And we had seen double-digit increases in the decades prior to that. So something's going on in healthcare. People are holding down costs just because they can feel it. Patients are starting to question, do I need that test? You know, what is that for? There's a big health literacy movement trying to involve patients in their health care, trying to help patients make informed choices and share in that decision making. So I've seen those projections. Maybe I'm fatally optimistic, perhaps, but I really think that we're going to be constraining costs in our healthcare system in general. There's a tremendous amount of waste. There was a recent poll that surveyed physicians across the country, and we as physicians estimated that up to 26% of our health spending might be defensive medicine. You know, worrying about getting sued, so you order that next MRI when you kind of know it's probably not necessary. Those kinds of decisions that are made. So, I think there's a lot of waste in healthcare. I think the electronic information network and exchange will help a lot. I think so. We can't think of this Medicaid expansion as just one thing in a static system. Everything is changing right now.
And so, let me just connect these together. Then, are you saying that because the costs are lowering, that the projections for what this Medicaid expansion is going to cost may be too high?
It's possible.
Right.
Could also be that they're too low if the federal government doesn't stay at its 90% support in the future. But let me just touch on
just on that point, though. The governor is suggesting that if the federal money doesn't come through, that this program be cut back.
Yeah,
pull the plug.
Well, let me cite what's happening now with our hospitals in terms of their approach to losing the DSH payments, these mm-hmm. disincentive payments for hospitals. Hospitals that provide a lot of indigent care have been receiving some payments from the federal government. This is an example, the fact that that's being eliminated now, and Missouri hospitals face the possibility of losing a large amount of funds. You recall our then Speaker of the House, Pelosi, who said we're going to have to pass this bill before we find out what's in it. Unfortunately, we are finding out what's in it now, and one of the things is that they assumed that they could force all of the states to participate in the Medicaid program whether they wanted to or not. Turns out that was unconstitutional. Perhaps it was just an oversight. But at this point, what they need to do is look back at this legislation and write it as if they acknowledged the legitimate option of a state to decline expansion for any one of a number of reasons and then continue to provide those DSH payments for our hospitals. Now, the DSH payments reductions are ramping up over the next several years. For the first couple of years, first 3 years or so, they're not very severe. I believe it's Columbia Regional Hospital. Their DSH payment loss would be $27,000 in the next fiscal year. For the university hospital systems, it's in the mid-200,000s. But then in the ensuing 3 or 4 years, it ramps up. That gives plenty of time for our hospital system and physicians, all of us, to go where the problem was in D.C. to get this remediated. You know, folks want to come to the state and ask us to fix it. It's kind of like if you have plumbing work done on your house and it springs a leak the next day, you don't go to another plumber. You go to the plumber that did the work. So the federal government made this error in constructing this bill. They need to address it by reinstating the DSH payments.
Okay, I want to come back to that after we take a break. We're going to have to stop here for a second for a quick break. Again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the proposed Medicaid expansion in Missouri. Joining me in the studio are Karen Edison, Director of the Center for Health Policy at the University of Missouri, and Representative Keith Frederick, Chairman of the Missouri House Committee on Healthcare Policy. Both of them doctors, so they have that expertise as well. We're going to take a short break, but you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 573-882-8925. So if you have questions or comments or experiences with Medicaid, I hope you'll call in and join us, and we'll be back after a short break. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the proposed Medicaid expansion in Missouri. And joining me in the studio are Karen Edison, Director of the Center for Health Policy at the University of Missouri, and Representative Keith Frederick, Chairman of the Missouri House Committee on Healthcare Policy. For those of you in our audience, what questions or concerns do you have about the proposal to expand Medicaid in the state of Missouri? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We were talking just before the break, about the federal fix to this and the state role in that. And one of the things that strikes me about this is that this conversation that's going on in Missouri is representative of many different states that may not agree with what's going on at the federal level and are trying their best as states to do what they can to not go there, right, in terms of trying to opt out. I mean, we had this conversation in Missouri about setting up the healthcare exchanges, and no, we don't want to do that as a state. And now the Medicaid expansion is having a similar conversation. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, the relationship between the states and the federal government as it relates to these healthcare policies that are kind of coming down the pike. Karen Edison, maybe we'll start with you on that.
Well, Ruben, I think we've talked about this before, but I worked in the federal government for 2 years. I was a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellow back in the 106th Congress. So I worked on the U.S. Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee from 1999 through 2001. And during those 2 years, we were actually working on this health reform legislation. I actually worked for the Republicans. I worked for a moderate Republican from Vermont named Senator Jim Jeffords, but I worked for the committee. And we looked at this program, we tried to make this a very balanced set of policies. But whenever you're doing 18%, you have a law that affects 17-18% of the entire nation's GDP, it's going to be big, it's going to be complex, and there are going to be unintended consequences. Bottom line, it did pass, it was signed, it is the law of the land. You know, we can't renegotiate it right now. Nobody who was working on health reform when I was there or since that time thought that this would be the be-all and end-all. All these innovative ideas on how to reform these programs, how to do things differently, there are pilots and experiments going on all over the country looking at different ways to pay for health care and different ways to provide health care. But this particular Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, if you will, is the law of the land. So there's no renegotiating that right now. So what our decisions are how are we going to respond to that federal law? Because every state has a program with the federal government that's part federally funded, part state funded, that is their Medicaid program. You know, this coming in and saying we'll give you 100% for 3 years, that's pretty attractive to a lot of people who don't even bother themselves much with health and health care. You may have heard that the Missouri Chamber of Commerce has recently come out in support of this Medicaid expansion. And many other groups are beginning to do that as well, recognizing that it is the law of the land. And so as a state, we have some important decisions to make on how we're going to deal with that in the near term here. But I think this conversation about how to do things better is an ongoing one. And I think there are going to be new laws and new tweaks and new programs as we go forward, as we struggle to change this monolith, you know, that is our healthcare system, which really just deals with, like I said, sick care. You know, health is not about the hospital or the doctor's office. You know, healthcare is about where you live, you learn, you work, you worship, and you play. You know, that's kind of the new thinking now.
I was going to say, that's a newer way of thinking about healthcare that our current government policies don't really reflect, right?
Right.
Well, let me ask you this. How much harder would it make it to change the Medicaid system if it's expanded already? Like, how much of this restructuring of the system or refocusing things like Medicaid need to be done before we make it bigger?
Well, having a huge influx of money, quite frankly, will make things a little bit easier from my perspective. You'll have some flexibility and some resources where you can try some different things.
And would that be allowed under this expansion if it were to take place, or does it have to expand the way the system is now?
Well, the state always has to go to the federal government and ask for waivers if they want to do things differently, but this happens all the time.
And Governor Jindal, in a recent letter to the president, did point out that the waiver system, the system by which you apply for a waiver from the federal government, is really badly broken. That it is.
You're referring to the governor of another state there.
Yes, Governor Jindal in Louisiana. Yeah, but he brought out a number of concerns that governors and legislatures across the country have about the expansion of Medicaid. And one of them is the fact that we have been penned in for so long and restricted badly from trying any sort of significant reforms. There are a few states that are doing reforms now. I recently went to a summit in Florida on the Medicaid cure. They did a pilot program down there in five counties, and I went down there to learn about what they did. And they've had some success in those limited areas of the state, and they're looking at rolling it out. But John Goodman points out in his recent book that these systems are very complex, and you think they're transferable from one area to another. It often doesn't work out that way. So I really worry. We have billions of dollars at stake. We have 800 and almost 80,000 patients on our Medicaid system right now. I think doing a vast restructuring of the system before doing a carefully planned and implemented pilot program would be a mistake. So my opinion is we should try to improve what we have before we invite more people into it. And Ruben, I just wanted to mention one other component of the program that I'm proposing as a Medicaid reform. You recall that I said that patients would be allocated an amount of money equal to what was historically spent on them. You, I think, referred to it as a type of a voucher type
of thing. Well, I think that it and sounds like what we've heard in other instances terms of voucher being the word.
But a key portion of this would be that if that patient is able to consume healthcare services in a much more consumer-oriented way, just being smart about how they spend those funds. For instance, not going to the emergency room for a routine care item. They would get to keep a percentage of the savings, and the state would put a portion of that away for outlier-type care, and then the rest would go to the remaining Medicaid population. I think there's a game changer there, because the patient is then incented to save money. It'd be as if the patient or the person on food stamps now had no limit on the amount of food that they could go buy. That's basically what's happening with our Medicaid system now. They can go to any venue for their care without regard to cost and can incur and request any test without regard to cost, something that the rest of us can't do. And there's not enough cost sharing. We need to have some cost sharing, copays, deductibles. Now, these patients don't have that money, so we advance them the money in terms of either a voucher or this medical stamps, and they get to keep a portion of that. So they get some skin in the game.
Let me ask you this. That project in Florida, one, it talks about incentivizing – you just mentioned this – incentivizing the patients to make good healthcare choices. How likely are the people who would qualify for Medicaid, how likely are they to be able to make those kinds of choices in a really effective way that's going to benefit their outcomes? Karen Edson, maybe we'll have you weigh in on that question. Is somebody who's working at that level of income – who's busy trying to raise their kids, do all these things, are they savvy enough to be able to navigate the kind of choices they would have to make in order to get those incentives?
Well, that's a very good question. And there are two points I'd like to make. One is, I've heard on the radio lately some people talking about people who don't have health insurance and, maybe they're able-bodied people who just refuse to work. The truth is most of our uninsured are working and in working families. And, they're paying through their payroll taxes for, Medicare and other programs while they're not able to afford health insurance. So that's a myth I'd like to dispel. Most people who don't have health insurance right now, who aren't covered under our Medicaid program, are working. The other issue about how can they empower, how can we empower them? How can we incentivize them to be healthier? That is a very complex question. And really, I believe in local health care, if not regional health care. I think that as he mentioned, you have a program in one area doesn't mean it'll translate into another area. We have a very diverse population. We spoke, I think, 80 different languages at our medical center last year. We have a diverse communities of patients in our state, and we have diversities among our communities. I really believe the future is about communities coming together and joining forces and understanding their populations and figuring out ways that they can incentivize patients in the short term and the long term in a way that's meaningful to them. In order to have an authentic therapeutic doctor-patient caring relationship, you really have to have some level of understanding about a patient, what they believe, whom they trust, what stories they pass down through their family, how they get their information, how they think about healthcare. So this whole health literacy movement's big, you know, this whole movement about trying to understand communities and understand patients and empower them to tell us how we can do a better job taking care of them. I think this is a big part of where we need to go in the future. And I think that's going to be largely a local, if not regional, phenomenon. Because what works for the Hispanic Latino population in LA County doesn't necessarily work in Sedalia, Missouri. So we really need to figure out who's out there, who are we, you know, bound to care for, and how can we better do that in a way that's consistent with their values and their view of reality.
Right. And does does the way that the federal dollars are coming down into Missouri support that sort of finding of local solutions?
Not really. You know, the Medicaid expansion, as Dr. Frederick said, is really expanding a program that we already have. The health insurance marketplace, which is the other half of this coverage expansion, really relies on the private market and the private health insurance companies we have now in the state.
Right.
So, you know, again, health reform was just the first step. There are many other steps we need to take to reform how we're thinking about and how we're executing on health services for our patients. You know, this old model of the patient taking off work and coming and sitting in my office and waiting for me and coming in the exam room, and, you know, that probably is going to be about yesterday, not tomorrow. I always say, you know, yesterday was all about the hospital. Now it's really all about the ambulatory care environment or clinics and things like that. And tomorrow it's going to be about wherever that patient is, in their home, on their phone. We're going to be taking healthcare to patients where they are and expecting them to be partners in that care and take some personal responsibility for their lifestyle choices. But we have to put the structures around them that make that possible for them to make good decisions. You know, in my department and in my Center for Health Policy, we encourage exercise during the day, and our employees are healthier for it. You know, I think we need to do a lot of things differently in our society to really encourage healthier lifestyles and put off those diseases before people get them.
And who's going to drive that change? Because right now under the system, the doctors get reimbursed for seeing patients, mm-hmm. right? And the hospitals make mm-hmm. money by billing patients for
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance mm-hmm. companies, you know, I don't know how that works for them. But so who drives the change that you're describing if the federal programs are not
right.
incentivizing those kinds of things?
And so in the Affordable Care Act, there was just the very, very beginnings of provider payment reform. It's not comprehensive. It's really pilots and experiments around the country looking at moving away for paying for services in quantity and looking at paying for them in terms of quality, looking, you know, moving away for paying for volume and toward paying for value. And that means paying groups of healthcare providers as a bundle, if you will. You may know that already hospitals are not getting reimbursement if they have a patient they discharge from the hospital and they have to come back within 30 days for the same problem. So newly, we have hospitals concerned about what happens to patients when they leave the hospital. You really can change the incentives in healthcare with our health policies to incentivize things that we want to have happen. So that's really where we need to go. It's just a big system. There's a lot of redundancy and a lot of waste in it. But, you know, you say, well, what's one person's waste is another person's food on the table for their family. So we have to make some of these changes gradually. We have to do things in a measured way so that we don't really disrupt this large piece of our economy. But I think many people in healthcare and in health policy are beginning to understand that we really need to do that.
Right. Let me remind our audience one more time. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the proposed Medicaid expansion in Missouri. Joining me in the studio are Karen Edison, Director of the Center for Health Policy at the University of Missouri, and Representative Keith Frederick, Chairman of the Missouri House Committee on Healthcare Policy. For those of you in our audience, we have a few minutes left. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org, so feel free to call in or send in your questions or comments. We've got some comments in our chat room. We've got a lot of stuff kind of flowing there. I want to put one out here that says, first of all, Barbara in our chat room says, you know, Obamacare, if you want to call it that, is about total health, including preventative care and helping poor persons get early care instead of much later when they're desperate and their conditions have advanced and are much, much more expensive. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Some other stuff from our chat room here. Representative Frederick, I wonder if you could clarify a little bit. This comes from a comment in the chat room about, you know, poor people getting care if they're not going to get it from a Medicaid expansion. So in terms of how you think that problem could get addressed in the meantime if the Medicaid expansion is not going to take place in Missouri. So if it doesn't go through, how do we bridge that gap in the near term while more pilot projects are being run or while other things like that are being debated?
One thing that our federal government could do right away is to reinstate the DSH payments and not let our hospitals lose those reimbursements that they get for providing indigent care. And toward that end, I introduced a resolution, co-sponsored a resolution in the House to call upon the federal government to do exactly that. And Dr. Edison did mention, point out that the ACA, Obamacare, is a law. It has been upheld by the Supreme Court. But I do believe that some errors were made, and this is one of the most egregious, I think, in that for states that are not going to expand or turn out not to expand their Medicaid program, their hospitals should not lose these DSH payments. I might also point out that physicians have never received DSH payments. The hospitals, though, have become somewhat dependent on them. So that's one thing that could be done.
Let me follow up on that real fast and just make sure I understand this. So is that a viable strategy for indigent care, is to pay the hospitals for covering people who are uninsured to help to fray that cost?
It just helps keep the doors open. It helps keep particularly our rural hospitals from having to shut down. If they're on the bubble, not really making, you know, not in the black, and they don't have sufficient reserves, it could be the difference between surviving and not surviving. So for those folks that live in that area, it's critical.
Right. And how, I mean, is that something you'd want to see sustained in the long term, or is that something that eventually you'd want to see go away and replace with some other way to cover those people's medical care?
I think that's beyond the scope of what I'm prepared to respond to right here and now.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I think we have a lot of things on our plate without solving that long-term
right.
problem, but it's a legitimate thing to
because
discuss.
Because it is one of the big questions here, right? I mean, that's come up in the national healthcare conversation, that it's very expensive to treat people in emergency rooms and would be a lot – the money would be better spent treating them in other ways.
And
right?
So how do you do that? You incent them not to go to the emergency room for routine services. You know, folks that are indigent or poor, they're not stupid. So by empowering them with – essentially vouchers or dollars to purchase health care, they can make those choices with a provider network that best suits them, with a list of services and benefits that best suits them. In Florida, they hired folks called choice counselors to help them through that process of deciding which one of these programs would best fit my family. That helps to engage them, as Dr. Edison was mentioning earlier. I share that concern. We want folks to be engaged with their primary care provider, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
I have a daughter who is a resident in family medicine in Springfield, and the asset that our primary care physicians and our nurse practitioners and our physician's assistants, all the members of the team, many of the things that you've said we have complete agreement on. So, but the problem is now the way the Medicaid system is set up, it's not sufficiently flexible to allow those things to be introduced. And we do see that our commercial insurance, the marketplace, will respond to those sort of needs and will then, you know, Dr. Edison mentioned folks that were working poor. They had a part-time job or two but couldn't afford health insurance. How about the idea of allowing an employer who can't foot the total bill for health insurance, maybe they can kick in $50 or $100 a month to go toward their health insurance. Maybe we establish something that allows mom and dad or grandpa and grandpa to kick in $50 or $100 or maybe one of the local charities to kick in some money. So we need to be freed from this sort of old method of providing health services through our Medicaid system. One final thing. It's beyond the scope of what we're talking about right now, but Dr. Ben Carson mentioned about lifetime health savings accounts. You get one as soon as you're born. You keep it your entire life. And at the end of life, you can will that to your kids. This whole idea about the death panels and all that discussion.
If there's any left, of course, right? It's an unpredictable thing. Retirement accounts are the same way.
It depends on how you fund it and how you use it. But if there is anything left, perhaps, you know, my own case, if I can see the writing on the wall and I know that the last 30 days I'm going to spend $150,000 or $200,000 of my kids' inheritance for no good quality of life, maybe I don't need a counselor or maybe you do need someone to help you through that. But the point is, right now there's no incentive to not consume the maximum. But it does have a cost. And there is a lot of cost at the last 30 days of life.
Mm-hmm. Right. Go ahead, Dr. Edison, please.
I was going to say that's true, and that's a conversation that has been difficult. I hope that at some point we're able to have a sort of cross the political spectrum, rational conversation about those healthcare costs at the end of life. I would say one of the concerns from the health policy community on the sort of the voucher idea. I think all ideas are worthy of vetting. One of the concerns I have, and maybe it's because I see so many people from rural Missouri in our clinics who have put off health care, is I worry a little bit about incentivizing people not to get care. That just concerns me a little bit. I think, though, we have to have a balance of these policies where we actually incentivize what we want. And what we want is we want people to get preventive care. And that's why in Obamacare, that was 100% covered. And it is 100% covered so that people don't have to pay for that. But we want people also to go to their primary care clinics and providers, and we want them to engage in health care. So we don't want to create any incentive that encourages them not to do that. What we would like to disincentivize them to see Dr. Frederick and myself, probably, you know, sometimes the specialist, maybe not as often as their primary care. I think this carte blanche, go to anybody, get as much health care as you want. I think there are some things we can do around the edges of that. Right. And I think we can partner with our primary care colleagues to help, you know, give them the benefit of our expertise without having just that carte blanche open access to anything in healthcare.
Yeah, we have a question from the chat room to clarify something that you said, Representative Frederick. Just when you talked about, you know, decisions about total spending in a lifetime about health on healthcare, and people making decisions about, okay, maybe I don't need that because it's more money spent, that sounds dangerously close to this phrase death panels that has been bandied about on the national level quite a bit. And I just wonder if you could clarify that a little bit, because that whole idea of limiting the amount of health care somebody gets is really confusing and alarming to a lot of people. So could you clarify what you mean exactly by deciding that there's a finite amount of health care coverage that someone might get?
It's not my idea. It was recently proposed by Dr. Ben Carson.
Okay.
And it just made sense to me. I mean, after being involved in healthcare for over 25 years and thinking about my own personal situation, I think it makes a lot of sense, because the choice would be up to the patient and the family. There's no third party. There's no panel that's sitting around deciding your quality-adjusted life years. You're familiar with that concept about how many good years you have left.
Right.
In some countries, they use that as part of the criteria for whether you would qualify, say, for instance, for a total knee replacement. This would get rid of that entirely.
Well,
this would empower the patient.
Who would decide the dollar amount that everybody starts with?
I don't think Dr. Carson has described all that in detail, but it's a concept worthy of fleshing out.
Right, right. Okay. Another comment from the chat room, you know, is this idea about family members contributing into the working poor. You know, how likely is it that people in that sort of socioeconomic group would have family members who might be able to help contribute to their health care needs?
It's probably directed to me. Probably not all that likely, but there shouldn't be a barrier to it. But there may be some charitable or philanthropic organizations that may want to participate in that. So there should at least be the avenue.
Okay. Another question that came in from the chat room here is from one of our audience members. Why not accept the Medicaid? Because that would solve a lot of this problem. Why not accept it in the short term? This is, again, from one of our audience members. Why not accept it in the short term, work out some of these issues, and then potentially roll back the program after some of these things are sorted out?
I think a lot of people are kind of coming around to that, honestly. For me, it's partly who are we as a people who are we as a society that we do turn our backs on our most vulnerable people? And we do that. You know, a lot of people don't get health care because they don't have health insurance and they don't want to run up a big bill. And they don't come in for health care until it's very, very late. And I see these people. And so I think when you're a doctor and you see a lot of people who really put off their health care and suffer and, quite frankly, die earlier, it just makes me think, who are we as a people and what are we doing in our society? Do we not need a safety net for our most vulnerable? And then we can have all kinds of different programs and policy changes, but I would like to see us at least get a safety net for our most vulnerable.
Representative Frederick, your thoughts on that?
My response to that is that I worry particularly about the impact of broad expansion of our current Medicaid system on those who are the most vulnerable. I think they would be crowded out, services would be further rationed, and we would actually hurt those who need it the most. It's a system that does not provide us good outcomes, and we shouldn't be expanding it. We should be trying to get these folks into the type of programs we know that are associated with better outcomes.
Let me ask you this. Do you foresee any kind of scenario under which the Republican-controlled legislature in Missouri might go ahead and say, well, if we do this, 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 or this, we can go ahead and accept this federal money and kind of live with that for the next couple of years?
You know, I don't presume to speak for the House of Representatives, but knowing my colleagues, I think we're open to discussion of good options and looking at all the options that are on the table and taking input from knowledgeable people like Dr. Edison. So I think we're certainly in the process now of looking at all the options, including expansion and including reform.
Right. And are there provisions that would be palatable to you personally in terms of voting in favor of an expansion, or are you completely ready to say no?
I think, again, I have an open mind to the situation, to what we're facing. But I think I have more concerns now than I have confidence that it would all just work out fine if we just expanded it. I think there are a lot of problems. I think we'd be taking a long walk off a short pier.
Right. Dr. Edison, your prognosis on this?
Well, we haven't talked about the jobs that might be added. And the university study that was recently done looking at the expansion said we would have 24,000 new jobs in the first year. And I think a lot of people who are, you know, really looking at job creation and the economic viability of our rural hospitals are kind of coming around to maybe we ought to go ahead and do it, but we need to all keep working. We need to keep working across the aisle. We need to be, you know, all these innovative ideas that Representative Frederick was talking about, all of those things are worthy of vetting. All those things are worthy of putting on the table. We are better together, putting our ideas together to see how we can incentivize the kind of behaviors we all want.
Right. Just real quickly, we only have a couple seconds left on this jobs thing. Is it possible to find 24,000 people to do these jobs?
That's a good question. And are we training people to do the healthcare jobs of tomorrow? Are we training home health care workers to use technology?
I mean, when you ask the question, it makes it sound like maybe not.
We, in health policy, those of us who think about the future can envision some different kinds of jobs in the future that might be useful. And so those of us training healthcare providers are beginning to think about that, think about how we need to supply the healthcare workers in the next generation.
Okay, we're going to have to stop there because we're out of time, unfortunately. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us today, Karen Edison, Director of the Center for Health Policy at the University of Missouri, and Representative Keith Frederick, Chairman of the Missouri House Committee on Healthcare Policy. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Our program is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Our producer is Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our studio director. I'm Reuben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.